Hello there in internet land, and welcome once again to the D&D podcast. I'm your host, Mike Merles, and with me today is Rodney Thompson.
Hello.
So this is a special edition of the podcast. Now, with time available and stuff notwithstanding, hopefully we can do this more often. But you may have noticed that last Friday, we ran a D&D game that we live streamed on the internet on Twitch TV. And this podcast is essentially a follow-up to that, kind of captures some of the processes we go through when we're assessing the game as we work on it, where we play test, then we talk about the game. It's sometimes we will, if we're just playing to play test, we'll stop and talk about a rules point or something. A lot of times, too, when we're actually doing play tests, they're a lot different than the game that you saw. We have stress tests. And Roddy, why don't you talk a little bit about the stress test concept?
Our stress testing process is a lot like playtesting super intensified. Basically, what we do is we'll go into a stress test with certain goals, certain mechanics we want to analyze, and we will really hammer on those mechanics without a lot of the stuff that goes around that portion of the role-playing game. So, for example, if we really want to test how well a certain class is doing in combat, we will basically jump right in and do many back-to-back combats, super intense, testing this specific mechanic or this specific monster or something like that. And it basically is one of our mantras is if we start slowing down, we say, too much role-playing, keep going, right? Because, you know, all of our natural tendencies are to fall into stuff like that. But if we're testing, you know, this class's combat mechanics, or if we're turning around and testing this particular monster, or, you know, oh, we really want to test the exploration rules, it is a much more intense, less framing narrative, less really framing gameplay around that. So that's our stress testing process, which is what we use to really zoom in on individual mechanics.
Yeah. Now, the normal playtest process is we basically just play D&D with the latest rules.
Right. Like, there's a lot of, you get a lot of practical information out of that kind of play as well. That's best for, we don't have anything specific we want to test at this exact moment, but we need just general testing going on in order to get good feedback on, you know, what's working in general and what's not, and also to identify things that we later will then playtest more intensely. I mean, if a problem comes up in a more generalized, you know, standard D&D adventure style playtest, we can then take that and say, okay, this thing created a problem in one of our playtest games. Let's refine it and then stress test it, right? And so it's kind of a weeding out process, and that's why it's good to have many groups doing the sort of high-level overview standard D&D adventure playtesting and then identify problems and zoom in on those in the stress tests.
Yeah, and a lot of that comes down to two different approaches people take to DMing or the campaigns mm-hmm. they run. What I think is the strength of that approach and why we use it is when people say are running a home game or a more casual game, they're running it just as a DM with their own particular preferences, because DMs have different ways they want to
right.
run games.
Right.
So the game of yours that I play in on Tuesday night, you have your approach to DMing,
right.
and then I have like my approach, and everyone has, you know, different ways they approach. Like, I know for myself, I would be a terrible person to say, hey, like, I get to decide exactly what D&D is like in terms of catering exclusively and only to my DMing preferences, because I'd be just like, I don't need rules, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
I don't care about any of the rules. I just need to know a basic idea of like monster stats and everything else I just make up.
Right.
But that's just how I run things, right? Because
right.
I've been playing D&D since like 1981. What I just need are rules that are easy and fast for me to use, right? As opposed to other DMs who are more, well, I want the rules. I want to create a challenge within the rules and work within the rules, because that's challenging and more interesting to that type of DM.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit closer to that style of DM in that I do a lot of prep work in advance of my sessions. I mean, you're playing my game, and you always see that every
yeah.
session I come with 2 to 4 pages of notes. Those notes I bring to each session are new each session. I don't bring old notes to the session. I do, but I'm bringing a fresh set of prep that I use the standard rules to do all my prep work, and I build all my monsters, and I plan out my encounters. And then when I'm at the table, though, I'm much more freeform. So basically, I want a lot of the front end rules and prep work to do away from the table. When I'm at the table, I want to run it, I don't want to say fast and loose, but I want to be able to change gears quickly, to change the pacing as, you know, we see things are going in the session. So I'm a little bit closer to that style, I think, than you are.
Yeah. And it is interesting, because D&D, unlike other games, it's part of why I like working on the game, is there are DMs who would say, we don't know how this works, so let's look it up. And there are DMs who would be like, well, let me just make a ruling, or I'll just, whatever, someone roll a die. And your game has to support both.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to have a game where we assume you're going to look everything up. Like, or, I'm sorry, we have to assume you can look everything up because there will be a DM who wants that. But if you have to look everything up, then the DM who's more, I'm just kind of a storyteller or stage manager, or I'm just here to entertain people, is that getting away of that person's style? Mm-hmm. Yeah. But obviously the guy who wants the rules to tell him, you know, hey, I'm not really sure how this should work, so I need a rule to help me out here. You don't want that person to be left, you know, high and dry. So it's a very interesting balancing act. And I think it's probably been one of the more difficult things working on next is getting that balance down correct. Yeah. Because I think D&D has gone to extremes. We've never had the middle ground. We've had either kind of like make it up, or we've had here's the exact rule for climbing a ladder in a windstorm of with winds of 80 miles an hour and it's raining out, right? Like, as opposed to just who knows how you climb, right? Like, like a basic D&D where, especially well, that, in the Red Box, there's no real rules for that.
Yeah, that's where I really like having sort of I like having both, because when I'm at the table, I don't want to have to look things up, but I don't mind looking things up away from the table, right? If I'm sitting down to build my dungeon in advance, and I know that there is a room in the dungeon with 80 mile an hour winds and it's raining in that room and they have to climb a ladder, I don't mind being able to look and say, okay, what kind of stuff would this do to the DC, and then write that in my prep notes, right? So like I want to do that away from the table, not at the table. And again, that's just my personal style. Is I don't mind the prep work, but I do want at the table. Basically, I like it if 90% of everything I need at the table I can keep in my head.
Yeah.
And then that extra 10% is what I did the prep work for.
Yeah. It is tricky because you want to give a rule, but you also want to give the rule that says, don't use this unless you want to. Like, never, like, the idea of rules lawyering and stuff from a player, it's always like, well, that's more someone's suggestion. Like, that's the way I think the game should run, is the DM is the host, right? The DM is kind of like, this is my game. We use the word my specifically because there is a sense of ownership. Mm-hmm. The DM is running the campaign. While the players have a stake in it, the way D&D works, the DM has a bigger stake in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so rules lawyering as like, oh, like the player is going to use the rules against the DM. Like, if there's a way we could have very comprehensive rules, but ensure that no one ever tried to buffalo a DM with them, that would be perfect, right? Yeah, because then you'd have the DM who's like, I want to use the rules, just use them. And the DM was like, I just want to kind of make up stuff as we go. Then they're both comfortable. And that's why I think it's useful to have the sort of the marker of DM rules versus player rules of saying, hey, players, here's generally the rules, how they work, but your DM will determine at the end of the day how this actually works.
Yeah. Well, it's easier for a DM to do a deep dive or a shallow dive based on their preferences than to try and guess what the players want, right?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, on the player side, players kind of have to follow the rules because they're not always making up the world as they go along. The DM is making up the world and the adventures. And the DM gets to choose, like, do I want to be, like, the guy who really follows the rules really tightly, or do I want to run a little more fast and loose? And it's a lot easier for a DM to make that choice and have the game run just fine than it is for the players to be trying to make that choice. Yeah. It doesn't always work as easily, because that's one person having to decide how to run things as opposed to six people having to agree on it.
Exactly. And it's tricky because when you look at D&D as a game, as the culture around it, what we need more of, more than anything else, are DMs.
Yeah.
And so the easier you can make it for the DM to just decide, I'm not going to care about the details, or I am going to care about the details, having that carry through, rather than saying every DM has to DM this one way.
Right.
You make it much easier. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, without DMs, you don't have a group. And so, I mean, you could in my experience, at least, it's always been easy to find players. It's been hard to find a DM.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's kind of our philosophy is to say we'd rather let the DM figure out how many of the rules you're going to use or ignore, because if the DM isn't comfortable running the game, there is no game. You know, if you as a player don't like the way your DM's running the game, you just go find another DM. Yeah. Or if none of the players like the game, they just all leave.
Right.
But if you can't, like, if you can't find a DM or there's only one type of DM we can possibly support, that's going to really hurt the game in the long run.
Well, and that's why I think that our sort of layered approach to the rules, are when we talk about our basic rules, our advanced rules, et cetera, this is where I think it actually is going to be better for dungeon masters, because if the guy who wants to run a game a little more fast and loose runs the game his way, and the DM that wants to really have a lot of rules for, you know, monster building and terrain and obstacles and hazards and whatever, is also running the game using, you know, all those things. And those two DMs are running, are actually both playing by the rules accurately, and there's a through line between what they're doing that matches up. I think that's sort of the ultimate goal, because that means that Fast and Loose guy and Super Rules Intensive guy, they are both playing by the rules.
Yeah.
This DM has simply chosen to use more of the rules, right? Yeah. It's not like, okay, well, you're breaking rules if you play this way. No, no, no. You're choosing to use a subset that gives you what you need, right? So and it's important to remember that that guy needs the basic streamline rules. The other player needs, the other dungeon master needs more. He needs those monster design guidelines, and here's how to create, you know, crazy set piece encounters to make him happy. And I think that's the ultimate goal, is that that is not in a different set of rules. That is a layer on top of the rules that will make that DM happy.
So
anyways,
yeah. Well, I think it's an important thing to talk about, because really what's, that's the big goal, is just with Next, is to just embracing the idea that people play D&D for different reasons, and there's no one right way to DM, and there's no one right way to play. It's like we're kind of like making a set of paints, and we're not going to tell you like what picture to paint. We're just going to say, here are some interesting tools. Use them as you will. And the tricky thing with an RPG is you're kind of painting as a group, but one guy like owns the canvas in a way, right? Yeah. So there is like that one player, the DM, who has a little more authority than the rest.
Yeah.
So speaking of the game we ran,
yes,
what was your takeaway in terms of putting on your designer hat? Like what was your takeaway of things that you saw that came up that you thought, oh, this didn't really work out well, or this would need some work?
So there were a few things that sort of immediately popped up. And part of it, I think, is during the live stream, I didn't want to, you know, stop the game and say,
oh, yeah, that's kind of what we're doing.
Right, exactly. I didn't want to say, hey, this is what's going on, and we should think about this. But
like,
you know,
I think we're already on thin ice. Like, would people enjoy watching us play? Maybe. Would people enjoy watching us argue about whether this thing is working? Probably really not. But yeah.
So. All the scintillating action of sitting in a conference room and listening to us talk about things. I mean, yeah. So, but then again, that's what the people that are listening to this podcast are
exactly
going to get. So, hey,
it's just like our approach to the rules. If you opted into this,
that's right. You've chosen to get that layer of icing on the cake. So, I did take some notes sort of on the side and things that I wanted to address. And it's funny, I didn't actually know what we were doing in this podcast until we walked in here, and I had just finished sending an email to you about one of those issues. But I think one of the things that popped out for me were there are a few places where we've got a little bit of weirdness with some of our saving throws.
Yeah.
The ghoul, for example.
The ghoul irritated me.
Yeah. And the thing about the ghoul is actually sort of a two-part issue right now. Because on the one hand, you know, the ghoul needs to be sort of scary, and like the paralysis effect is really classic and everything. But on the other hand, it's making multiple attacks, and each of those attacks is making... Yeah, exactly, so, right? And the thing is, the multiple saves then in turn distort the any kind of, you know, other saving throw issues we might have, right?
Saving throw issues, yeah.
Yeah.
No, I had the same exact... For background, so I ran the module not quite cold. I just reviewed it maybe a half hour before I ran it. A lot of the backstory stuff was like based on reading the module and seeing some stuff that's in there, plus some stuff for the next session, which we'll be recording. The plot thickens and all that. But yeah, as soon as the ghoul showed up, I'm like, well, in the original module, there's like 8 ghouls and 2 ghasts, or like 10. I'm like, there's no way this can work. And then I'm like, well, should it be working or not? I was like, okay, I'm going to punt that question. I'm just going to try to make this work. So, okay, there's going to be 4 ghouls. And part of me was like, okay, that was like, you know, kind of scary, and like they're trying to drag you off and stuff. But part of it was like, man, this is like a lot harder than I really kind of wanted it to be as a DM, right? Because I was thinking, no, this shouldn't be your 5th level characters. These are like, what are they, 2nd or 3rd level monsters?
Yeah, something like that.
They got the drop on you because, I mean, when you guys were doing your checks, basically established like your passive, you know, perception kind of thing, they beat that. So, okay, you're going to get ambushed. It was like, okay, your cleric like wandered into the room. So that's not very good because he's going to be the first person to get jumped on. But yeah, like rolling the 3 attacks and then the 3 saves, that was just a real beating.
Well, I mean, I think what it really boils down to is that we've got these saving throws on each of those 3 attacks, right? And then that in turn is 3 chances to fail the saving throw. And we know failure is really bad. But the thing is, I think when we look at like the XP value of the ghoul, for example, we sort of looked at it as like, okay, this thing makes multiple attacks and they do this much damage. And then this thing can paralyze you, and that's worth X amount, not really taking into account how both of those things combine with each other. And so there's a little bit of just like, okay, obviously the ghoul in its current incarnation is tougher than its XP value would suggest or its level would suggest. But I think also part of it is just the gameplay experience side of it. Three chances to apply an effect that takes someone out for a round or more, and with the terrible dice luck we had. I mean, I should have gotten out of the paralysis very fast. I mean, I had a really good con and everything, but then I didn't, and I kept failing my saving throw. And then, you know, it's sort of a problem compounding another problem type issue that I think that when we look at any of those, you know, sort of take you out of the combat effect. I mean, it's sort of like how you would treat stun in fourth edition, right? We used it pretty sparingly, and not a lot of monsters paralyze you in the bestiary right now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we are seeing an example of, okay, this is an exceptional monster that is going to paralyze you. But yeah, just the three chances on every multi-attack to, you know, to paralyze you, I think is, it's not a great bit of monster design right now. And I don't want to downplay sort of the system side of thing, which is the saving throw thing, which we haven't even really talked about yet. But yeah, also, like, the, you know, just the content design of the ghoul obviously needs some revision.
Yeah, my feeling is, my big issue with it was these are third level monsters going against a fifth level party. And yeah, they got the drop on you, but it felt a little too life or death for, like, they're supposed to be that level.
Yeah.
The issue right now is, and so this kind of ties into a bigger picture thing of, now that we have the class content pretty much solid, you know, based on feedback and some of the changes we've made, this is really now the segment of the process where we lock in the math.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't make sense to lock in the math, but be like, well, but the thing you're doing isn't fun, or it isn't really true to what the class should be or what mm-hmm. people expect it to be or want it to be. Getting the math right without getting that right first doesn't make any sense mm-hmm. because we've just, okay, we've made this mathematically perfect system that no one actually likes playing.
Yeah.
And so what struck me about it was the up to this point, we really haven't had many saving throw bonuses
right.
other than your stat modifier. The thing that irritated me the most about it was thinking, I think this fight would have been just as hard if you were 10th level characters.
Yeah,
know, like still four ghouls jumping on a 10th level cleric as opposed to the 5th level cleric would have had roughly the same ability to take you down.
Sure.
And I think I wouldn't be surprised. Like, one of the things I've been thinking of is if we just did something simple, like you add half your character level to all your saving throws.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so then we know, okay, saving throw DCs will scale up a bit. The important thing for me being low level creatures have lower DCs, higher level creatures can have higher DCs. Just like you'd kind of expect,
mm-hmm.
and that fits into what should be going on in the game. The other nice thing is that if you look at dragons or something like that, when you have these very powerful creatures, if you can imagine the dragon attacking a village,
mm-hmm.
the dragon's saving throw DC for its breath is higher, that just makes it deadlier. Like, you know, the town militia that shows up to try pelting with arrows, those guys are really terrified because the breath hits them, it's going to kill them.
Yeah.
They're probably going to blow their saves. Probably even if they make their saves, they're going to die.
Right.
But there's that aspect of just like, oh yeah, the creature's a little scarier now. It's a little less random when it's fighting mobs of guys. Because
mm-hmm.
we've had some issues when we've been playing with the mob effect of the 10th level fighter is more afraid of the 8 orcs than he is of the single hill giant.
Right.
You know, so kind of finding some ways around that.
And we've taken a little bit of that into account when we look at like our encounter building guidelines. If you're fighting many monsters, if you're outnumbered, that's obviously a much tougher fight because there are, again, more opportunities. And then when you think about, okay, now there are many lower level monsters that have multi-attacks, that's even more opportunities for things like paralysis or other status effects to get slapped on you. So there are obviously still some challenges there.
Yeah.
And I think the saving throw thing. The funny thing about saving throws is you look at something like attack bonuses, and we give you a scaling attack bonus if you're a weapon using class, right? And there's a spell casting bonus right now as well. But saving throws don't have a similar scaling on them, right? And
yeah.
the big goal of what we've called bounded accuracy up to this point is not for you to remain static, but for you to get better at a reasonable pace so that lower level monsters stay relevant. They don't completely fall out,
yeah.
but they should get easier, right? You should have an easier time fighting something that is lower level, but you should still be able to fight them in the context of an adventure and not have it be completely ridiculous, like you've just completely lost them entirely, right? So I think that, you know, saving throws might be another area where we want to look at a similar bonus. I think the plus half level might be a little extreme, but you know, we scale attack bonus, we should consider something like that for saving throws as well.
Yeah, and if you look at something like the ghoul, you could argue, okay, if you're a higher level, And this actually is an argument against having, like, breaking up their attacks into three, when really they're just three small attacks rather than just having, like, an attack, a single claws attack that can do half decent damage. Right. Is if you're, like, a 10th level fighter fighting a bunch of ghouls, you're maybe nervous about getting paralyzed in the back of your mind because there's, like, 10 of them and they have to make a bunch of saves.
Right.
But at that point, you're probably more afraid. Just there's 10 of them. They're all going to attack you.
Right.
Just, like the orcs. And that's what kind of made me think about half level. So you could kind of say, hey, as creatures, like, become lower level relative to you, their physical attacks remain a threat, which is nice because that's a nice threat against all characters, whether you're the wizard or the fighter, you're still kind of worried about that. But their special effects start to fade out. Like, lower level characters worried about ghoul paralysis. Higher level ones really aren't because they know, well, I can probably make the save. The DC is low enough or my bonus is high enough.
And that's a great example too. Like, paralysis is effectively infinitely scaling.
Exactly.
Because paralysis against a higher level character is technically a more powerful effect than it was against a lower level character.
Exactly. And that's what we don't want is, like, you know, you can imagine in the when the vampire and his minions attack the high level party or attack the village, the answer is, hey, who's going to take on the 10th level fighter who lives in town? Well, the vampire will go deal with him personally. It's not the vampire sends 10 ghouls.
Right.
You know, the 10 ghouls attack the town guard, right? Or, you know, leading the zombies or skeletons. It's, you don't want to have these distortions in the story, like the physics of D&D, the game world, where it's like, that just is kind of weird that, like, the chumpy minion guys are attacking a hero.
But I could see in the same context, right? The vampire sends his ghouls to attack the fighter to wear him down, like hit point wise, right?
Exactly.
Because it's like, okay, I don't want to fight the fighter at full hit points because he will wreck me. So I will send my cannon fodder in. Yeah, they're probably not going to take him out, but they still can do something.
Yeah,
right?
And maybe they'll get lucky and paralyze
him. Right.
But it's going to be more like, well, now we're looking at he needs a bad roll or something like that. So that was my big takeaway too. The other interesting thing, this is kind of like my secret, that might make you wince because I know you, since you're doing a lot of balancing, I don't use any of the DM prep stuff when I run because part of me just wants to know that I can, drawing on my years of experience as a DM, come up with roughly balanced encounters or roughly fun encounters or usable encounters just by feel.
Yeah.
Right. Like, if you're familiar with something enough, you should be able to just kind of gut it from, you know, my point of view, as far as, like, you know, 30 years playing the game. Most of it, except for the ghouls, everything seemed to go pretty much the way I kind of expected. I mean, the orcs were just chumps. Like, they were, I mean, guys at fifth level, they really weren't supposed to be a threat.
Right. In any edition of D&D, right, depending on what kind of orc you're fighting, basically, fifth level characters shouldn't care as much about, what, four orcs, right?
There's four orcs, and there's, like, the four half-orcs you talk to that you
get. Oh, right, those guys.
Yeah. And then there's the Sundew, which was, like, one of those, like, oh, it's just basically a barrier from, like, the very tournament style.
Right.
Like, oh, what's the puzzle? And, I mean, your puzzle was just blew it up for what's in the room.
Yeah, whatever. I thought it was good.
Well, that was part of the fun. It was like, okay, why is all this stuff this way? And so I've come up with, like, a little plot. That'll become more apparent as we play next time, like, why things are the way they are. And a lot of the stuff with the orcs and them being afraid. So, yeah, does anything else stick out as, like, this would be an issue we've been talking about, like, in a postmortem of the...
We talked about things that didn't work really well, like the ghouls and some saving throw issues. I think those are still, you know, they're obviously sort of the top of the list. There are also some things that I thought worked really well. Like, I was pleased with a lot of the class features. Some of that was invisible to a lot of the people watching the game because we weren't taking every opportunity to explain every mechanic we were using. But also, like, we used the exploration rules. We used the dungeon exploration rules kind of invisibly, which I think is the way we want it to happen, right? Is we want... When you switched to exploration mode, there was sort of a seamless transition there where you asked us, you know, for our checks or whatever, and you recorded those, and then that was what you used to determine if the ghouls ambush us. We were using that process, but it just sort of flowed into the natural part of the game. And I think that's a great example of being able to identify something that the playtest, the sort of all-around adventure playtest revealed is moving in the right direction. I think there's still some rough patches. We've talked about those offline as well, but I think that was a good example of, okay, we have a set of rules that govern, you know, how you're exploring and what you find and do you get ambushed, and you're able to use those and not break the narrative. And we didn't have to jump into okay, guys, here's the totally different thing that we're going to do for a while. It was, no, I'm going to keep watch and you're going to look for traps and, you know, so forth. So
as a DM, what I really liked about that, but the one thing I liked about the ghoul fight, except when I actually read the ghoul stat block, was like, oh, right, was how the surprise went, where I didn't have to break up the flow of play. Where, I mean, in some ways, Greg took his cleric, was a tree? It's cleric.
Tree, there, yes. Yeah. Tree, the cleric.
You know, kind of blundered into the room because it was nice. I didn't have to go, oh, everyone, when you open the door, everyone make wisdom checks. Mm-hmm. Or what's your passive perception again?
We'd already done that, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it was kind of nice that I could just write down that number. And then just, you know, when you open the door, I just made the check for the ghouls. I don't know if you noticed this, no one tried to sneak. Mm-hmm. So the ghouls heard you coming. Mm-hmm. You know, like there wasn't a, hey, let's try to be stealthy or anything like that. Yeah. So it's like, okay, the ghouls definitely know you're coming because you're walking along, right. You know, talking and all this other stuff. So that was also kind of nice too. A lot of the stuff that before could interrupt the flow of the game and maybe give players kind of indicators of, oh, he asked for wisdom check. So maybe the cleric isn't going to go storming into the room because, right. Well, there might be something here. We just don't know.
Well, you made it like the exploration rules make it an active thing that the player does. And if there's an expectation that you are going to actively do something while exploring, then that will determine how all the reactive things like surprise, how those work. I think that is a big step towards making it so that exploration just feels like a natural thing. The other thing is, I think this play of exploration rules highlighted some places where we can do some interesting things in like the classes that interact with this as well. So for example, you said none of us were sneaking. Well, I was playing a rogue and I felt like, you know, I needed to be searching for traps because I'm exactly. Really good at that, right? Should I be able to search for traps and sneak at the same time?
See, I would say, I don't know if I would want
you. Maybe the answer is no, right?
But it is interesting. The other thing we talked about, this hasn't been public yet, but we talked about incorporating like marching order in a rough way to say, okay, if you're the rogue, you can sneak and we assume you're like X feet ahead of the party.
Right.
So what I could imagine happening with the ghoul thing was the ghouls don't hear you coming. So when you walk up to the door and kind of peek in, they're like hanging out, lounging around.
Right.
And that's how you can get. And so even though the party, maybe you go back to the party and then the fighter and everyone else, okay, they can hear them coming, but you averted the ambush by spotting them first, right?
Yeah. And that might also just be another case where we need to get more used to using the exploration rules where I could have effectively said, okay, you guys wait back here. I'm going to sort of become my own party for a moment, exactly. Right? Sneak ahead, look around, and then come back, right? And then once we got up to the door, I'm checking for traps and what have you. So
yeah.
I think that's also just a part of like figuring out exactly how to make the exploration rules work to our best advantage. Yeah. And, you know, me as a rogue player knowing, okay, I need to be both looking out and searching for traps as well, because if I'm going to be ahead of the party, that's kind of my job here is to be the lookout.
And that might be, something interesting that just a rogue class feature that just says you can, when you're exploring, you can search for traps and stuff.
Maybe like or when, you can always when it's see. Just you, like yeah. when you're off by yourself, you can both search for traps and, you know, sneak at the same time. I think that would be a cool thing.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing to balance because what we don't want to have is a mechanic where, and this is what we got back with the threshold mechanics we had, where it's like, hey, you automatically find every trap with DC X or higher.
Yeah.
Is it just turns the game, makes the game too predictable, mm-hmm. You know, where it's like, okay, all my traps, you're either the rogue doesn't spot them or the rogue automatically spots them. Mm-hmm. And that's where I like the die roll, the exploration rules coming in, rather than just a passive score, which is a set number.
Yeah.
Because then as a DM, at least, I feel, and based on the feedback, I think a lot of people agree with this statement, that it makes it too much as a DM, I'm kind of choosing to hose the players, as opposed to like, hey, the kobolds have built a pit, they didn't do a good job hiding it, it's a DC 10 to spot it. If I know that you're always going to beat a 10, then it's like, well, why am I kind of like, I guess I'll put that there.
It's kind of a foregone conclusion,
yeah,
right?
It's really just flavor. Like, you're going to find like badly built traps.
I mean, in the context of like a published adventure, it makes sense because like, you know, you don't know what's going to be in that. But if you're a DM building your own adventure, you sort of know what your players can deal with. And it's like, well, if there's no die roll, why you just made it one higher or one lower and you're fine. I will say this though, I really missed the threshold mechanics when I was sneaking around because I was rolling terribly. I mean, just awfully. I was the least sneaky rogue in the history of D&D.
I don't mind it though, because to me that makes the game more interesting. As a DM, it makes things go in ways you might not have expected.
It might be that this is pointing me towards like feat design, because if there was a feat that I could take that said, hey, when you're sneaking, you have a threshold, I would have absolutely taken that feat in a heartbeat.
But you were able to sneak when it counted. Well, actually, no, the orcs didn't even try to find you. So you were just hidden. You were just out of sight, and they were just like so scared, witless about, oh, crap, we don't want to die tonight.
Yeah.
That was another thing I threw in. So this is not an actual rule, but during the fight, at the end, and this is where I like, I mean, this is what I like about third edition and fourth, when you have like a nice regular mechanic, I just have the orcs make a wisdom save. Like, okay, so what I basically decided was these guys are going to run because three of their friends are dead and they're scared already because this is a creepy ass temple they're living in. They want out. I had to make a saving though to see if they're going to withdraw or run. And I rolled a two. And I think their wisdom was like plus one or zero. So like, yeah, that's what they just turned and took the opportunity attacks because they both basically just lost their minds with terror. Like, we're getting the hell out of here. We're scared.
Well, I mean, they're facing fifth level adventurers who we were clearly outmatching them at that point.
Yeah. And they're already nervous, already kind of like on edge. So, and that's the kind of probably my DMing style in a nutshell. I like to kind of surprise myself sometimes. Like, I think this might happen this way or that. I'll just roll a die or I'll make a check on behalf of this NPC to see
what he does. It's really not that far off from some of the stuff we've been talking about with our interaction rules, though. Because, I mean, you in one of your Legends and Lore, you talked about, you know, giving monsters certain traits that you can use to determine how they act, right?
Yeah.
I could very easily have seen that these particular orcs, since they had been cowed by the humans, effectively, and were kind of, you know, second banana in this city, I could see them having a trait that you could look at, like, okay, they are cowardly or, you know, whatever, so that when you looked at them, you say, okay, they would do this. And that's sort of what you did in your
just
head,
intuitively,
right?
Did. Yeah, I think my description of these guys. Yeah.
But in designing an adventure, we would want to use those, I think, those interaction rules a little bit to say, okay, here's what's happened in the city. Here's, you know, what these orcs are having to deal with the humans. They would act like this, right? Yeah. And we can basically build that into the adventure or, you know, monster or whatever you want to say.
Basically, for those faceless orc NPCs, essentially having an archetypal personality that they're all following.
Right.
The orcs serving the guys in this temple they're cowardly, they're malingerers, they're looking for a way out. You know, like when you fast talk the orcs, and right. I don't know if you were thinking of this way, but you said, oh, they're meat pies. And you're like, yeah, that's plausible enough. Like, we'll leave now because we'd rather not be here, but we're just kind of looking for an excuse to get out of here because this place is scary. People keep dying.
And what had led me to that point was you had talked about basically how the humans were clearly the top dogs, right? And the orcs, who, you know, in the wilds would expect to be sort of the bullies, right, were themselves being bullied. So I was like, okay, they obviously don't, you know, they don't like the situation that they're in. How can I get them to think that they can get out of it, right? And I think that's a case where what I was getting from the adventure was mixing with sort of my knowledge of orcs in general and producing what my action was. And I think that that's sort of the basis of a lot of what we want our interaction rules to do eventually.
And so what I think I want to do for the next session is I'll email everyone and say, hey, let's use – so we've actually been working on some core rules for role-playing. And when I say core rules, I'm probably way overstating the actual depth of it.
Right.
But there's this basic idea of, like, charting out your character's ties to the world and your personality traits. And so I think I'd like to – I'm going to ask everyone to do that for their characters, like do that little sheet we had figured out, basically the character sheet thing of – your goals, purpose, drives, and all that stuff. And then do our little Benny's kind of mechanic on top of it, which right now is a core rule. You guys haven't seen this yet, but basically we have a core rule that's there to reward role-playing. If you act in character, if you do things like, oh, that's kind of foolish, but that's what your character would do, to give you some rewards. So I like to kind of feature that.
Well, I think that'd be cool too, because I don't think people realize this, but we were actually playing with pregens. We didn't build these characters. These are the pregens out of Ghost of Dragonspear Castle that we were using. Yeah. So none of us had really a lot of choices to make in what character we played, other than I will play this pregen. So I think that'd be cool. And I think also that would show off a little bit what we're looking forward to with our interaction and role-playing mechanics, because it's a big part of that side of the game, I think.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, that wraps it up for this week. Hopefully when we play again in live stream, we'll have the time. This is kind of an ad hoc thing we did, but I was just thinking, well, it'd be kind of nice to see the other side, the meeting that would follow up the playtest.
Right.
And we can keep these going, give you guys some commentary, and maybe show off also some other people from R&D DMing so you can see some different styles that are in the game. You get to see me play, which I don't know. I'd have to edit myself.
It's dangerous and psychotic. Those are the two words I would use.
Yeah, I am probably a player than most people. I don't know.
You're great, Mike. You're a great instigator. The instigator personality was built for Mike Merles.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say I play Kender, but
not quite that far.
Yeah, not that far, but it's in that direction. So
yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next time. Keep playing D&D and keep enjoying RPGs in general. Thanks.